Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour asks, what is more central to our current economy, security, and core values than science? Where would we be without Google and Apple? Technology, gene-based therapy, and high-tech prosthetics. Recent national studies show that at the elementary level, science is barely being taught. More than 8 hours of instructional time are devoted each week to teaching English language arts and over 5 hours per week to math. By comparison, science is taught for less than 3 hours. Over the next 6 years, as Generation No Child Left Behind, more on that in a moment, goes through high school, we can expect banner headlines about further drops in science learning and fewer students taking advanced level courses in biology, chemistry, and science, and the falling number of American students majoring in science of all types, and then a renewed clamor from employers who need appropriately educated workers but cannot find them. The woman who wrote those words in an article titled America is Losing Another Generation to Science Illiteracy is our guest this hour, Dr. Margaret Honey. She is president and CEO of the New York Hall of Science, which is this really amazing place in New York we'll learn about, which is giving students and parents and anybody who wants to go there hands-on and inspirational look at the world of science and how, and opens up people's imagination to interacting with exhibits and thinking about science in the world. She is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls, of course, as we always do. If there are science teachers who are not yet in school, we are particularly interested in hearing from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Margaret Honey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, and for inspiring us to do a show on this. So why is it so many hours of language arts, so many hours of math, very few hours of science when that's where their jobs are? Why is it?
Well, the reason is a pretty simple one. Math and English language arts are the two areas of the curriculum where we're testing and where that testing counts in terms of schools making annual yearly progress. So one of the consequences of the No Child Left Behind legislation has been that we've focused very, very heavily on math and English language arts and given much less emphasis to other areas of the curriculum, particularly science.
Mm-hmm. And that indeed is where many of the jobs are. You hear in this economy, which is so awful, that there are companies that are waiting to hire people who have scientific knowledge.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was just meeting with one of our board members here at the New York Hall of Science, and he runs a very large global IT consulting company, 130,000 employees worldwide. And he said that at any given time, they have 500 openings in the U.S. where they're looking for qualified engineers.
Mm. You suggest in the article, or at least you ask this question and then knock it down, tell us why, we need to be wary of what might seem to be the obvious solution. Why don't we ensure that science is tested the way math and English are?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we've seen, again, under No Child Left Behind, is that, grade-level, high-stakes testing tends to have the effect of narrowing the curriculum. This is more true in schools that are struggling and that feel extraordinary amounts of pressure to get their kids performing effectively on the tests. So it's not true across the board, but it's certainly true in schools where, you know, kids historically haven't been doing all that well. And one of the consequences of that is that the curriculum becomes a kind of test prep becomes very narrowly focused on the skills the kids have to master in order to pass the tests, rather than focused on sort of richer, more engaging kinds of activities that can be used to build skills effectively, but at the same time, you know, keep kids interested and engaged and motivated in learning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, just putting more testing in our schools is really not what we should be thinking about. And, you know, one of the interesting things, if you look around the world and you look at other developed countries who participate in the international assessments that are part of the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, OECD, OECD administers something called the PISA assessment. And countries that are doing better than us do not have policies that have high stakes grade level testing. Rather, they have tests that are typically referred to as kind of gateway tests. So when you're leaving the elementary level and going into the secondary level, kids will often be tested. When you leave high school or secondary and you go on into post-secondary or apprentice training, kids are often tested, and those tests are used as part of a placement strategy. But they don't have the same amount of high-stakes grade-level testing that we've instituted in this country.
We've become test-happy. We test all the time now.
Or test-unhappy.
Test-unhappy, right. Students and teachers, too. You hear a lot of teachers complain about the number of tests that have to be administered.
It's very hard on teachers. I think, you know, we've seen in the work that we do here that often, you know, in the more kinds of innovative or sort of out-of-the-box projects that we're trying to do, teachers often bring to the door their concerns about, you know, is this going to help my kids do better on whatever the test is? And it's a real challenge because we're not in a position to make those kinds of promises. Mm-hmm. You know, we think the kinds of learning opportunities we're offering are rich and engaging, and they build student skills in a kind of compelling way. But whether those transfer to pretty sort of narrow, high-stakes exams is another question altogether.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, a side issue here is that there is a lot that is hard on teachers right now, and that just seems to be growing.
Yeah, there's a lot that is hard on teachers. And, you know, I was at a conference a week or so ago and had the real honor of hearing people who have been very deeply involved in effective school reform initiatives talk about those initiatives. These were people from the province of Ontario in Canada, and then here in the U.S., the Montgomery County schools. And in both instances, what shone through was the importance of providing support to the people who are doing the work in our schools, teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you don't figure out effective ways to support and mm-hmm. help educators develop and grow their skills, and you don't give them the kinds of resources that they need to do that, and you, you know, sort of engage in a discourse that I think in this day and age is too much focused on teacher bashing, you do a real disservice to the children, ultimately. And, you know, these efforts were all about, I mean, they were planful, they supported teachers, they thought about using time and resources differently, but fundamentally, they thought about how to build the capacity of people who are doing the work in our schools. And I always say, you know, if you think about running any business, it could be a science museum or really any kind of business, you're only as good as the people you have who are your colleagues who are working with you. And why we would think schools should operate differently, I wonder. Seems to me that you know, the most important thing we can do is figure out ways to support educators at the classroom level.
Right. You must have some concern because of all that's going on about the number of people who will choose being a teacher as a profession. It's just, it's a complicated profession right now. And you're at a time when we desperately need more attention on science education. We also need terrific science teachers.
Absolutely. And we know it's a huge challenge, particularly in urban areas where, you know, the majority of teachers who are teaching science and mathematics are not certified. We don't have people who have been effectively trained and prepared in those disciplines in the classroom teaching. I also think, you know, not to put the whole burden on the backs of individuals, because there are plenty of individuals who may not be certified but who are trying to do a very good job in the classrooms that they're working in. You know, one of the other challenges in science education is that the dominant way in which we teach science in our school still in the 21st century is through the medium of the textbook. And the fact of the matter is that reading chapters and memorizing information and answering questions at the end of the chapter is not at all how science is done. And so part of the challenge in our school environments is to really reinvent and reshape the way in which science is taught so that it's a much more hands-on kind of deep investigation kind of activity than it is memorizing a bunch of often disconnected facts.
Tell me a little bit more about the New York Hall of Science. I've never been there, but I'm sure that you've put within its walls the kind of science education that you just described.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the New York Hall of Science is a wonderful place. We were built originally as part of the 1964 World's Fair, so we are located in the borough of Queens in Flushing Meadow Corona Park. We're right out near where the Mets play and where the U.S. tennis takes place every year. So we're in this wonderful park environment, and we are a hands-on, interactive, exploratory, discovery-oriented museum. And I think you're exactly right, Kathleen, that we know how to do and engage people in the kind of science that, you know, many of us in this field would like to see more of happening in schools. And I think one of the things to know is that there are 347 science centers like the New York Hall of Science scattered all around our country. And we're potentially, you know, a wonderful resource to work in partnership with educators who are working in schools to help introduce new teaching and learning methodologies into science classrooms there.
And tell me about I always like to know how people get to be where they are. Tell me about your science life.
Well, I'm actually a developmental psychologist by training, so I'm a person who has spent a lot of my career sort of focused on issues of children's learning and engagement. And my own background has been in the area of educational technologies and educational media and designing environments using those kinds of interactive tools to support students' learning and teachers' teaching. And I've had the good fortune throughout my career of working on many science-steeped technology projects, starting with a wonderful television show that was created in the mid-1980s at Bank Street College of Education here in New York called The Voyage of the Mimi. And the first Voyage of the Mimi was built around a dramatic television show that had scientists studying whales in the North Atlantic. The second Voyage of the Mimi was built around the ancient Maya and archaeology. And the Maya, of course, were incredible scientists, really interesting mathematicians, often credited with inventing the concept of zero, although there's some dispute whether they invented it or whether that was an East Indian invention. And they were also they were amazing astronomers and impressive architects. So I think early on in my career, I learned a lot about, you know, the power of utilizing compelling content and stories and really engaging activities as a pathway, as a really powerful pathway for kids into the world of science and science learning.
And when you look at your education, Margaret, do you think that you succeeded because of wonderful science education or despite the fact that you had poor science education?
No, I think, you know, my science education, sadly, was pretty typical. And I was very much a kid who grew up thinking that science was a kind of body of facts that you had to learn and you had to master, and that if you weren't really good at memorizing and holding on to those facts, you weren't going to be any good at science. And it really wasn't until I got out of school altogether, or was in graduate school, and working in an area that was all about how children learn and what motivates children's learning, that I began to engage in experiences that really let me understand science very, very differently. You know, science, like any discipline, yes, there are foundational things that one needs to know, but it is a field in which people working in it are, you know, in constant sort of conversation and dialogue with the enterprise, with the material, with the work that they're engaged in doing, and they're helping to shape and build it, and it's very dynamic and lively and engaging. But that's still, you know, here we are in heading into 2012, and I think that's still not the sort of dominant way in which we engage kids in science and school environments.
Margaret Honey is our guest this hour, president and CEO of the Hall of Science based in New York. It's a hands-on laboratory in Queens for science, technology, engineering, and math learning. A piece that she wrote caught our attention, in which the title was America is Losing Another Generation to Science Illiteracy. She talks about why that is the case and how we can change it, and how we're really off the mark in not making science a very engaging field of study that we treat as important as we do math or language arts studies, because it's where the world is. It's where the future is. 800-486-8655. One line is open if you would like to take it. You can also use this email address, which is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Ann in Manitowoc. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for your show. I think what you're saying is great. I agree with what you said about standardized testing and science. That's the last thing we need. And kids really like hands-on things. That in most learning is hands-on, and science is one way to do it. And it's a great way to do it. And I know a lot of us have been told by your principals unofficially, it's okay if you don't do science and social studies. You do the reading and math. So what you're saying, a lot of us have found to be completely true. And especially since you can teach, I mean, there's so much good reading in science and social studies, like the nonfiction books. And, I mean, you give kids nonfiction books on earthquakes and magnets and electricity. I mean, they love it. You have to teach them how to read it, but they love it. And and those FOSS kits, you're probably familiar with those?
Yes, absolutely. They are wonderful.
Oh, yeah. And
produced by the Lawrence Hall of Science, which is one of our, you know, colleague science institutions based in Berkeley, California.
What are these, for those who are not familiar?
They are called the FOSS kits, and I'm not going to remember what that acronym stands for, but they are wonderful hands-on, interactive learning curriculum for kids in at the K-12 level.
Oh. Right, and there's, like, different kits for different grade levels. And It's all hands-on science. But the comment I wanted to make, too, is that oftentimes we are not given in-service in science and social studies. It's mostly in reading and math. Now, reading and math are very important. I mean, don't get me wrong. We need those. But you don't learn how to teach science, especially hands-on, in 1 or 2 years. You know, it takes a long time just to get the kids, you know, to organize them in the groups. I mean, it's also, you know, group learning and things. I mean, it's just everything what you're saying is true as far as this is what we need for the real world. You know, the group learning and, you know, the excitement that kids have, you know, when they actually see that the magnets work or electricity. Oh, this is what electricity is. I mean, it's just cool. So, but you don't learn how to teach that overnight. So, it takes time, and you also need backup from your administrators. And I just wanted to say a lot of us just don't have a whole lot of that. So across the state and across the country. So thank you for your program, and a lot of us know exactly what you're talking about.
Thank you very much for the call. That's what you need. She's spot on that you need support for this. You need, it just seems common sense to me that of course we should be teaching this, and of course we should make sure that science is entertaining and hands-on and captivating to students in the classroom. It just seems like a given. Why is it so hard, Margaret?
Right. Well, I think Anne pointed out the, you know, the very real tension that schools are living with when, you know, she kind of quietly hinted that administrators are communicating the importance of teaching math and English language arts and really focusing on what's being tested, what they're going to be evaluated on, and that the support and resources and training and time it takes to do effective hands-on science learning isn't being invested in. Now, you know, that's not true across the board, but it is a very real tension in so many school environments. And particularly, as I was saying earlier, in those school environments where you have kids who are struggling or who are maybe not native speakers of English, who need more time and attention to get up to speed so they can pass the tests. You know, the research data indicates really clearly that in environments that have those kinds of stresses in them, science is pretty much absent altogether, as are other subjects like art and music, all of which are, you know, important to helping develop well-rounded, healthy, engaged, motivated young people.
Yes. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, to your guest. Right after World War II, I got a chemistry set from, I have two comments. I got a chemistry set from Montgomery Ward, or Sears and Roebuck, and that's, I think that was the best thing that ever happened to me. When I started teaching, I would set up a lot of little projects. Like, I set up a copper tank, did some, to show them how to do copper plating with copper sulfate. Then we had paper airplane contests 1 year, and then I got a hold of a good treadle sewing machine for the girls. And those girls learned how to use that thing, and they were always bringing something to sew to school. And then the kids got to the point where they were coming to school with their own creative ideas and things they wanted to do, and they were literally swamping the classroom with ideas and things that they wanted to do. And as a result, it just improved their academics tremendously. That hands-on can't be beat.
Those are really, really wonderful examples, and I think exactly the kind of thing that we want to sort of showcase and make happen much more broadly in our schools. I was thinking, as Eugene was describing his classroom, you know, what if our media and our newspapers and our television focused in on all of the incredible things that are going on in some of our schools around hands-on, engaged science learning. My hunch is we'd start a quiet revolution that would interest and excite and propel many more schools to do these kinds of things. Because the point that Eugene makes is that if kids are motivated and engaged, they're learning much more effectively.
Yes. Thanks, Eugene. As always, Charity in Madison. Hi.
Yes, I am a first and second grade teacher in a Waldorf school where we don't have a lot of the same pressures that a lot of the public school teachers have as regarding testing, et cetera, et cetera. And the main core of our science curriculum, at least in the very early grades, first, second grade, is really having children have experience with nature, being outside, having contact with plants, having contact with stones, and being out in rivers and lakes and things of that nature so that they have a point of reference and they have that outdoor experience. So when the science curriculum really comes into its own later, in third, fourth, fifth grade, and above, they have this point of reference and this hands-on throughout their whole school curriculum. And I think it's just invaluable for that that experience of being outside and that experience of nature to have as a foundation for further science study. And I just a comment, and I can take my any comments.
All right.
Here.
Thanks, Charity. Thanks. Margaret?
Yeah, I think Charity is making a really wonderful point. The engaging young children in particular in hands-on activities that anchor them in the nature that surrounds their lives is just, you know, it's fabulous. And there probably are no better ways to engage and motivate and begin to sort of nurture young scientific minds. It's that kind of work that we, you know, we need to make happen more broadly and for everyone. And, you know, even kids who are in urban schools could have all sorts of opportunities to explore their own backyards, even when they're, you know, there aren't necessarily lakes and rivers around. There's still all sorts of interesting work that can be done.
Tom in Madison, hi.
Hi. Oh, hi. Good morning. I'm really enjoying the conversation here. I'm a former teacher myself. I'm not working in the profession anymore, but I just think that when we have discussions like this, particularly about teaching science, which is the topic of today, we sometimes talk right up to the issue and around the issue, but we never really address the issue. And the issue in my mind is not so much that we've got all these teachers out there who supposedly aren't prepared to teach science or don't know how to teach science. The issue should be, who is training the trainers? Who is teaching the teachers or the future teachers of America how to teach science? And I don't think that gets addressed often enough. I'll give you just one quick example. When I went through my teacher training, and I won't name the school, but it was a major university in the Milwaukee area, that's all I'll say. I had my science class that we had to take, and they didn't have a science teacher that year. They didn't have anybody to teach the course. So they just tapped the recruiter, the education recruiter, that was his full-time job basically, said, well, you know, why don't you teach this science course? And this guy was so far out of his element and league. I remember the one science experiment, if you want to call it that, that we did, he gave us all little pots with some dirt in it and some bean seeds or whatever, and we planted bean seeds. And then he took them up to his office and put them on a shelf in the sunlight. I don't think we ever saw him again. I don't remember seeing him again, and there was never any follow-up.
Oh, no.
Okay, what did you learn from this now? I mean, I learned possibly that you can plant a bean in soil and it's supposed to grow. I mean, it was just totally ridiculous. So I think really more attention really needs to focus on who is training our teachers, and that's my comment.
Thank you very much. Well, what's the answer to that? Who is training the teachers, Margaret?
Well, I just want to thank Tom as well. We have enormous problems in our teacher education and teacher preparation programs, and Tom's story is probably all too true still in this day and age. And I think, you know, I think we're at a moment in time when a number of states and municipalities are developing and creating alternative certification programs. I think that we need to think about creating some of those programs in highly specialized ways to train and prepare people who are really steeped in science, steeped in mathematics, knowledgeable about the use and roles of technologies, knowledgeable about the power and potential of computation and computational thinking. And where, you know, chances are that's not going to happen from within our current schools of education, given how they're designed. So it's another reason I'm a real advocate for thinking about creative ways to tap the power and potential of institutions like mine, science centers, because we could be very, very powerful venues for training next generation science teachers.
Yes, you sure could. Well, that should happen.
Yeah,
and,
and
Tom should have been able to see his beans grow.
At the very least.
Right. Right. It's wonderful to see things grow, and then you have a bean. It's something. We go next to Joanne in Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I have an issue with what I have seen over the years in the teaching to test in the schools. I will give you an example. I had a daughter who in fifth grade was just doing fantastic in all areas, especially science and math. And we had to switch schools, and we went to a school where they tested her on a reading level, and she landed up in almost like a remedial reading level in this new school. One of her teachers at the end of the first month said, "I don't understand why she belongs here." And I said, "Well, you know, they didn't teach reading the same way. They gave them science projects. They researched the projects. This kid's nose was in a book all the time. And she was learning differently than how to parse a sentence or whatever. And it was sort of a blow to her that all of a sudden she's a failure. She came out of it just fine. But the point is that I think once in a while the school has to justify its existence by its test scores. And I think that's dangerous."
Margaret.
It's exactly right, Joanne. We were talking about that a little earlier in the show, that, you know, testing has really had, I think, the unintended consequence of narrowing the curriculum so that much of what is being taught is only what is being tested. And, you know, I've been in and out of schools all over the country where what kids are doing day in and day out are, in effect, test prep kinds of activities that have them doing very sort of low-level skill kinds of worksheets, you know, filling in the little bubble items, those kinds of things. And that's just, it's not learning. It is not effective learning, and it's not learning that is going to build the kind of talent that we need in this society to really continue our growth and, you know, all of the good things that we have been accustomed to in the United States.
And thank you for the call. The other thing we should spend a moment on here, and you've talked about it some during this hour, but let's spend a little bit longer on it, is what you describe as this unequal performance, and that we have among the most unequal performance in the world, with achievement levels highly dependent on socioeconomic status, low income, and minority communities are especially hard hit by lack of access to high-quality science resources.
Right. That's absolutely true. You know, and again, sort of turning to some of the OECD countries, Canada, Japan, and Finland in particular are countries that have very, very, very successfully narrowed the gap between students who come from low-income backgrounds and students who come from high-income backgrounds in terms of performance. They've gotten, you know, the vast majority of their kids performing at similarly high levels. And, you know, one of the sort of underlying challenges I think we face in this country is our schools are funded principally at the local level, right? They're funded through local tax dollars. And so by design, that makes for a very unequal and uneven educational experience.
Yes.
And those who have resources and can afford to move to, wealthier communities are able to put their kids into schools that have more resources and more opportunities for kids to learn. And it's, of course, much less true in under-resourced areas of our country. And I was looking at a new Department of Education website over the weekend that is chock full of all sorts of national data, and very, very interesting to look at this site. And one of the things that I was surprised to learn, the site is called Ed Data Express for your listeners. One of the things that I was very surprised to learn is that 44% of public school students in this country are classified as low income.
Hmm.
I didn't realize the number was that high. So nearly half of all of our school children attending public schools in America are low income kids. So we have a lot of work to do in terms of how we're going to invest and remedy the very real inequities that exist in this country.
We sure do. Margaret Honey is our guest this hour. Margaret is the president and the CEO of the New York Hall of Science. It's a hands-on laboratory in Queens for science, technology, engineering, and math learning. She came to our attention because of an article that she recently wrote titled "America is Losing Another Generation to Science Illiteracy." Two more of your phone calls in a moment. Our lines are filled. You can just wait a few minutes and you'll ultimately be able to get through. I can't say that with 100% certainty, but I think that you probably will be able to get through. And our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next caller, Terry in Deerfield. Hi, Terry.
Hi. This is just a wonderful topic, and I'm so impressed with how your guests can control her passion because I can't. I've spent 38 years teaching in the classroom, and I've seen it all come and go. And I'm retired now, and I still take kids on outdoor education excursions and things like that. But I taught social studies as a team leader. But what I've seen is testing has destroyed education as far as we used to teach interdisciplinary units, where we would bring in everything from tech ed to life tech, and we used to do a rainforest unit where we would spend all this time and all the skills were brought together, and we did these things, and what testing has done is made us go a mile wide and an inch deep, where we used to really dig in, and those kids, those students over the years that I saw, they became engineers, they became researchers, one of them became he's a doctor for NASA. These kids had a science background, but I think the young teachers today are coming out of science education, and they're doing a good job. But the testing has narrowed the curriculum. They have to teach certain things, it's creating a monoculture, as far as I can see. And diversity is what made this nation great. When we had, 10 NASA scientists 40, 50 years ago sat down, they came from 10 different backgrounds, and they put a man on the moon, and we don't have that anymore. We are so preoccupied with tests. So I'll take my comments off the air. But
thank you. Thanks, Terry. You're still doing things with children, too. That's great. Margaret.
We are indeed completely preoccupied with tests, and the kind of environment that Terry created when he was teaching is, in fact, the kind of environment that we should see in all of our schools in this day and age. Learning out in the world, learning when you enter the workforce, is all about being able to tap and access information and ideas across disciplines, across areas. And the fact that we're creating a situation in schools where, too much of the teaching is done in these isolated units and focused too narrowly on test prep is a travesty. I think one of the things I wonder about, and I think this is a really complicated issue, is there are schools out there that are sort of defying the odds and continuing to teach in very innovative and forward-thinking ways and getting good results on the tests. And I think, in those environments, it's probably a combination of both sort of secure and inspired leadership that's making it possible and a system that is willing to support and invest in teachers learning how to do something differently that's far more compelling and far more meaningful from the student's point of view, but that also results in, effective enough outcomes on the standardized assessments to keep a good program of work moving forward. But it's a hard thing to realize.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for people to trust in the idea that rich, deep, project-based education is going to yield the kind of performance that you want on these pretty narrowly focused standardized tests. It's a big stretch for folks.
Mm-hmm. Don in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Margaret. This is a great program. I want to add a dimension to this. You made the statement that memorization is not the way science is done. And Kathleen will know, in our Crossroads section of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this week, the lead article on the column says, science can lead to better readers. And the complaint is that kids are being taught to memorize words, and it doesn't work. And what's needed are phonics, the science of phonics, manipulating sounds and learning prefixes and suffixes and things like that. Teaching teachers the science of teaching reading skills is called for, because it's a preamble to being able to really do science as you're talking about it. So I just wanted to add that and call it to everybody's attention. Memorization is not the way science is done, and memorization is not the way reading skills and learning is done.
Thanks for the call, Don. Margaret, you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, I agree with Don. I think, what makes for good readers are lots of opportunities to be able to read and engage in all sorts of different kinds of materials. And, I had the good fortune of spending about 10 years working in a school district in New Jersey that was largely immigrant community from Central and South America, and many kids were, the vast majority, 95% of the kids, were not native speakers of English. And one of the things that that school district did so effectively and continues to do in this day and age is their classroom environments are what you would call print-rich. Lots of different kinds of reading materials, and they were so thoughtful about it that they created libraries of materials that were based around themes. So let's say in kindergarten, the theme is animals. They made sure that there were reading materials and books that could be accessible to kids who were at very different levels of performance. So what that means is that some of the stories were heavily picture-based, while other stories had many more words in them. But the point was they thought about how to build classroom environments in which everybody had something they could use, and that meant everybody had an opportunity to participate, and that meant everybody got to feel some sense of success and accomplishment. And it's worked very, very, very well for them for a long time now. Not hard to do.
Margaret, this has been weighing on me since you said this. 44% of public school students are low-income students. Where are all the other students who are more well-off going? Are they going to private schools?
Well, it made me wonder exactly the same question, Kathleen. They're about, I'm actually looking at this website right now. There are almost 50 million, excuse me, public school students in the United States. And it says percent low-income students, 44.2%.
Wow.
And interestingly, only 8.7% of our nearly 50 million students are classified as limited English proficient. So we I think, you know, we have a situation in this country where we do know from national data and national statistics that we have more children in greater numbers living in poverty than we have before, and that's clearly reflected in our public schools and, you know, heavily concentrated in our larger urban environments.
Right.
And we also know that in, you know, larger urban environments, smaller urban environments, you know, many parents who can afford to elect to send their kids to private or parochial
right.
schools. It's absolutely true. I don't know what those figures are, though.
Mm. So you're back to almost a separate, how can they possibly be equal situation?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think I was always struck with a story that Andreas Schleicher, who is the man responsible at OECD for the international PISA assessments, told once in a meeting. And he said when he visits schools in Canada or Japan or Finland, these countries that have closed the achievement gap, you can wander from community to community and pretty much see the same kinds of rich, compelling instructional mm-hmm. environments. And you can't do that in mm-hmm. America. Mm-hmm.
Let's go next to Rick in Monona. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I'm enjoying the program. My wife has a PhD in biology, and she came to University of Wisconsin-Madison to do a postdoc, and she decided to leave that, and she took a job as a teacher of elementary school teachers.
Oh.
She taught science to them in classrooms in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
and she'd have classes all over the state. And it was to make science fun and show elementary school teachers what they could do to teach science to kids and make it fun and interesting. And about 10 years ago, she was working on, it was all on soft money. It was all on grants and things. And when the grants dried up, her job went away. And all of a sudden, there's this vacuum, I think,
yeah.
of teaching, showing teachers, elementary school teachers, how to make science fun. So we're always surprised when we read in the paper that there's this huge influx of money into teaching science because we always wonder where it is or where it goes.
Hmm.
But that's one thing. The second comment I wanted to make, and that is sometimes we put up roadblocks to having good science teachers. My wife was excellent with, she always got great marks from the teachers that she taught. But when she went and started looking into the possibility of teaching high school science, she couldn't do it unless she went back and got her teaching certificate. She taught at the University of Montana, and she's very proficient at science and teaching, and yet there was that roadblock that wouldn't allow her to actually go and teach in a high school classroom.
Mm. We have about a minute left, Margaret.
Yeah, 10 years ago, there was a lot more money around to support the training of teachers. And that money, there was a pool of funding called the Eisenhower Grants, and I imagine that's what your wife was supported on. That's what the university and state were tapping into to support that work. That money went away for reasons that I'm not entirely clear about. But your story is a familiar one to me. And, you know, great for you, Rick, for raising the teacher certification issues. They continue to be very problematic. There have been increasingly alternative certification programs that have sprung up. This isn't even or evenly spread throughout the country, but in different areas it has made it possible for people who are highly credentialed, like your wife with PhDs in biology, to enter the teaching profession without the same hurdles and barriers in place.
Well, Margaret, what a meaningful hour this has been. Thank you so much for being with us. I'll look forward someday to seeing your Hall of Science.
Please.
Yes, I will.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Margaret.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Margaret. Margaret Honey, President and CEO of the New York Hall of Science. It is in Queens, if you're ever in the area, and it sounds like a wonderful place for science, technology, engineering, and math learning. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. I can think of five shows that should come as an outgrowth of this, so we'll work on them. Thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company. ATC provides a pathway for power into communities throughout Wisconsin. ATC owns and operates the high-voltage electric transmission system that helps keep the lights on, businesses running, and communities strong.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation. Clear, straight, open. From NPR News.